Disc 6.
I knew his behavior almost as well as I knew my own, and the idea that he wouldn't be doing exactly what he was right now was about as unthinkable as my letting another forensic pathologist take over the Warrington case because it was my right to take it easy at this stage in my life. I turned on the light in my spacious paneled office and opened the blinds to let the morning in. My workspace adjoined my bedroom, and not even my housekeeper knew that all of the windows in my private quarters, like those in my downtown office, were bulletproof glass. It wasn't just the Carries of the world who worried me. Unfortunately, there were the countless convicted killers who blamed me for their convictions, and most of them did not stay locked up forever. I had gotten my share of letters from violent offenders who promised to come see me when they got out. They liked the way I looked or talked or dressed. They would do something about it. The depressing truth, though, was that one did not have to be a detective or profiler or chief medical examiner to be a potential target of predators. Most victims were vulnerable. They were in their cars or carrying groceries into their homes or walking through a parking lot, simply, as the saying goes, in the wrong place at the wrong time. I logged on to America Online and found Lucy's ATF repository research files in my mailbox. I executed a print command and returned to the kitchen for more coffee. Marino walked in as I was contemplating something to eat. He was dressed, his shirt tail hanging out, his face dirty with stubble.
"I'm out of here," he said, yawning.
"Would you like coffee?"
"Nope, something on the road. Probably stop at Liberty Valance," he said, as if we'd never had our discussion about food that would kill him.
"Thanks for staying over," I said.
"No problem."
He waved at me as he walked out, and I set the alarm after him. I returned to my study, and the growing stack of paper was rather disheartening. After 500 pages, I had to refill the paper tray, and the printer ran another 30 minutes. The information included the expected names, dates, and locations, and narratives from investigators. In addition, there were scene drawings and laboratory results, and in some instances, photographs that had been scanned in. I knew it would take me the rest of the day at the very least to get through the stack. I was already feeling that this had probably been a Pollyanna idea that would prove a waste of time. I had gone through no more than a dozen cases when I was startled by my doorbell. I was not expecting anyone, and I almost never had unannounced visitors in my private, gated neighborhood. I suspected it might be one of the local children selling raffle tickets or magazine subscriptions or candy, but when I looked into the video screen of my camera system, I was stunned to see Kenneth Sparks standing outside my door. "Kenneth?" I said into the A-phone, and I could not keep the surprise out of my voice.
"Dr. Scarpetta, I apologize," he said into the camera, "but I really need to speak to you."
"I'll be right there." I hurried across the house and opened the front door. Sparks looked weary in wrinkled khaki slacks and a green polo shirt spotted with sweat. He wore a portable phone and a pager on his belt and carried a zip-up alligator portfolio. "Please come in," I said.
"I know most of your neighbors," he said, "in case you're wondering how I got past the guard booth."
"I've got coffee made." I caught the scent of his cologne as we entered the kitchen.
"Again, I hope you'll forgive me for just showing up like this," he said, and his concern seemed genuine. "I just don't know who else to talk to, Dr. Scarpetta, and I was afraid if I asked you first, you would say no."
I probably would have. I got two mugs out of a cabinet. "How do you take it?"
"The way it comes out of the pot," he said.
"Would you like some toast or anything?"
"Oh, no, but thank you."
We sat at the table before the window, and I opened the door leading outside because my house suddenly seemed warm and stuffy. Misgivings raced through my mind as I was reminded that Sparks was a suspect in a homicide and that I was deeply involved in the case, and here I was alone with him in my house on a Saturday morning. He set the portfolio on the table and unzipped it.
"I suppose you know everything about what goes on in an investigation," he said.
"I never know everything about anything, really." I sipped my coffee. "I'm not naive, Kenneth," I said. "For example, if you didn't have clout, you wouldn't have gotten inside my neighborhood, and you wouldn't be sitting here now." He withdrew a manila envelope from the portfolio and slid it across the table to me.
"Photographs," he quietly said, "of Claire."
I hesitated.
"I spent the last few nights in my beach house," he went on to explain.
"In Wrightsville Beach?" I said.
"Yes, and I remembered these were in a filing cabinet drawer. I hadn't looked at them or even thought of them since we broke up. They were from some photo shoot. I don't recall the details, but she gave me copies when we first started seeing each other. I guess I told you she did some photographic modeling."
I slid what must have been about 28x10 color prints from the envelope, and the one on top was startling. It was true what Sparks had said to me at Hoot Owl Farm. Claire Raleigh was physically magnificent. Her hair was to the middle of her back, perfectly straight, and seemed spun of gold as she stood on the beach in running shorts and a skimpy tank top that barely covered her breasts. On her right wrist she wore what appeared to be a large diving watch, with a black plastic band and an orange face. Claire Raleigh looked like a Nordic goddess, her features striking and sharp, her tan body athletic and sensual. Behind her on the sand was a yellow surfboard, and in the distance a sparkling ocean. Other photographs had been taken in other dramatic settings. In some she was sitting on the porch of a decaying Gothic southern mansion, or on a stone bench in an overgrown cemetery or garden, or playing the part of a hard-working mate surrounded by weathered fishermen on one of Wilmington's trawlers. Some of the poses were rather slick and contrived, but it made no difference. In all, Claire Raleigh was a masterpiece of human flesh, a work of art whose eyes revealed fathomless sadness.
"I didn't know if these might be of any use to you," Sparks said after a long silence. "After all, I don't know what you saw. I mean, what was, well..."
He nervously tapped the table with his index finger. "In cases such as these," I calmly told him, "a visual identification simply isn't possible. But you never know when something like this might help. At the very least, there's nothing in these photos that might tell me the body isn't Claire Raleigh." I scanned the photographs again to see if I noted any jewelry. "She's wearing an interesting watch," I said, shuffling through the photographs again. He smiled and stared. Then he sighed.
"I gave that to her. One of these trendy sports watches that's very popular with surfers. It had an off-the-wall name. Animal? Does that sound right?"
"My niece may have had one of those once," I recalled. "Relatively inexpensive? $80, $90?
"I don't remember what I paid. But I bought it at the surf shop where she liked to hang out. Sweetwater Surf Shop on South Lumina, where Vito's Red Dogs and Buddy's Crab are. She lived near there with several other women. An old, not-so-nice condo on Stone Street."
I was writing this down.
"But it was on the water, and that's where she wanted to be."
"And what about jewelry? Do you remember her wearing anything unusual?" He had to think. "Maybe a bracelet?"
"I don't recall."
"Her keychain?"
He shook his head.
"What about a ring?" I then asked.
"She wore funky ones now and then. You know, silver ones that didn't cost much."
"What about a platinum band?" He hesitated, knocked off balance.
"You said platinum?" he asked.
"Yes, and a fairly large size, too." I stared at his hands. "In fact, it might fit you." He leaned back in his chair and looked up at the ceiling.
"My God," he said. "She must have taken it. I have a simple platinum band I used to wear when Claire and I were together. She used to joke that it meant I was married to myself."
"So she took it from your bedroom?"
"From a leather box. She must have."
"Are you aware of anything else missing from the house?" I then asked.
"One gun from my collection is unaccounted for. ATF recovered all the rest. Of course, they're ruined."
He was getting more depressed. "What kind of gun?"
"A calico."
"I hope that's not out on the street somewhere," I said with feeling. A calico was an especially nasty submachine gun that looked rather much like an Uzi with a large cylinder attached to the top of it. It was 9mm and capable of firing as many as 100 rounds.
"You need to report all this to the police, to ATF, I told him. "Some of it I already have."
"Not some, all of it, Kenneth."
"I understand," he said. and I will. But I want to know if it's her, Dr. Scarpetta. Please understand that I don't care about much else at the moment. I will confess to you that I've called her condo. Neither of her roommates have seen her for over a week. Last she spent the night in her place was the Friday night before the fire, the day before it, in other words. The young lady I talked to said Claire seemed distracted and depressed when they ran into each other in the kitchen. She made no mention of going out of town. I see that you are quite an investigator, I said. Wouldn't you be if you were me? He asked. Yes. Our eyes met, and I read his pain. Tiny beads of sweat followed the line of his hair, and he talked as if his mouth were dry. Let's get back to the photos, I said. Exactly why were these photos taken? Modeling for who? Do you know? Something local, as I vaguely recall it, he said, staring past me out the window. I think she told me it might have been a Chamber of Commerce thing, something to help advertise the beach. And she gave you all these for what reason? I continued slowly going through the pictures. Just because she liked you? Perhaps she wanted to impress you? He laughed ruefully. I wish those were the only reasons, he replied. She knows I have influence, that I know people in the film industry and so on, and I'd like you to hang on to these photos, please. So she was hoping you might help her career, I said, looking up at him. Of course. And did you? Dr. Scarpetta, it's a simple fact of life that I have to be careful of who and what I promote, he candidly stated. And it would not have looked especially appropriate if I were handing around photos of my beautiful young white lover in hopes that I might help her career. I tend to keep my relationships as private as possible. Indignation shone in his eyes as he fingered his coffee mug. It isn't me who broadcasts my personal life. Never has been. And I might add that you shouldn't believe everything you read. I never do, I said. I, of all people, know better than that, Kenneth. To be honest, I'm not as interested in your personal life as I am in knowing why you have chosen to give these photos to me instead of to Fauquier County Investigators, or ATF. He looked steadily at me and then replied, "For identification reasons, I've already stated. But I also trust you, and that's the more important element in the equation. No matter our differences, I know you would not railroad anyone or falsely accuse."
I see. I was feeling more uncomfortable by the moment, and frankly wished he would decide to leave so I didn't have to do it for him.
You see, it would be far more convenient to blame everything on me. And there are plenty of people out there who have been after me for years. People who would love to see me ruined or locked up or dead.
None of the investigators I'm working with feel that way, I said.
It's not you or Marino or ATF I'm worried about, he quickly replied. It's factions who have political power. White supremacists, militia types who are secretly in bed with people whose names you know. Trust me.
He stared off, his jaw muscles knotting.
The deck's stacked against me, he went on. If someone doesn't get to the bottom of what happened here, my days are numbered. I know it. And anyone who can slaughter innocent, helpless horses can do anything.
His mouth trembled, and his eyes brightened with tears.
Burning them alive, he exclaimed. What kind of monster could do something like that?
A terrible monster, I said. And it seems there are many terrible monsters in the world these days. Can you tell me about the foal, the one I saw when I was at the scene? I assumed one of your horses somehow got away.
Windsong, he verified what I expected as he wiped his eyes on his napkin. The beautiful little fella. He's actually a yearling, and he was born right on my farm. Both parents were very valuable racehorses. They died in the fire.
He got choked up again.
How Windsong got out, I have no clue. It's just bizarre.
Unless Claire, if it is Claire, perhaps had him out and never got a chance to put him back in his stall, I suggested. Perhaps she had met Windsong during one of her visits to your farm? Sparks took a deep breath, rubbing his eyes.
No, I don't think Windsong had been born yet. In fact, I remember Wind, his mother, was pregnant during Claire's visits.
Then Claire might have assumed that Windsong was Wind's yearling.
She might have figured that out.
Where is Windsong now? I asked.
Thankfully, he was captured and is at Hoot Owl Farm, where he is safe and will be well taken care of. The subject of his horses was devastating to him, and I did not believe he was performing. Despite his skills as a public figure, Sparks could not be this good an actor. His self-control was about to collapse, and he was struggling mightily and about to succumb. He pushed back his chair and got up from my table. "One other thing I should tell you," he said as I walked him to the front door. "If Claire were alive, I believe she would have tried to contact me somehow, if nothing else, through a letter, providing she knew about the fire, and I don't know how she couldn't have known about it. She was very sensitive and kind, no matter her difficulties." "When was the last time you saw her?" I opened the front door. Sparks looked into my eyes, and once again I found the intensity of his personality as compelling as it was disturbing. I could not abide the thought that he still somewhat intimidated me.
"I suppose a year ago or so."
His silver Jeep Cherokee was in the drive, and I waited until he was inside it before I shut the door. I could not help but wonder what my neighbors might have thought had they recognized him in my driveway. On another occasion I might have laughed, but I found nothing the least bit amusing about his visit. Why he had come in person instead of having the photographs delivered to me was my first important question. But he had not been inappropriate in his curiosity about the case. He had not tried to manipulate me. He had not attempted to influence my opinions or even my feelings about him, at least not that I could tell. 11. I heated up my coffee and returned to my study. For a while I sat in my ergonomically correct chair and went through Claire Rawley's photographs again and again. If her murder was premeditated, then why did it just so happen to occur while she was somewhere she was not supposed to be? Even if Sparks' enemies were to blame, wasn't it a bit too coincidental for them to strike when she just happened to have showed up uninvited at his house? Would even the coldest racist burn horses alive just to punish their owner? There were no answers, and I began going through the ATF cases again, scanning page after page as hours sped by and my vision went in and out of focus. There were church burnings, residential and business fires, and a series of bowling alleys with the point of origin always the same lane. Apartments and distilleries and chemical companies and refineries had blazed into annihilation, and in all instances the causes were suspicious, even if arson could not be proven. As for homicides, they were more unusual and usually perpetrated by the relatively unskilled robber or spouse, who did not understand that when an entire family disappears and bone fragments turn up in a pit where trash is burned in the back, the police most likely will be called. Also, people already dead don't breathe CO or have bullets in them that show up on X-ray. By 10 o'clock that evening, I had, however, come across two deaths that held my attention. One had happened this past March, the other 6 months before that. The more recent case had occurred in Baltimore, the victim a 25-year-old male named Austin Hart, who was a fourth-year medical student at Johns Hopkins when he died in a house fire not far off campus. He'd been the only one home at the time because it was spring break. According to the brief police narrative, the fire started on a Sunday evening and was fully involved by the time the fire department got there. Hart was so badly burned he could be identified only by striking similarities of tooth root and trabecular alveolar bone points in antemortem and postmortem radiographs. The origin of fire was a bathroom on the first floor, and no electrical arcing, no accelerants were detected. ATF had been involved in the case upon invitation by the Baltimore Fire Department. I found it interesting that T.N. McGovern had been called in from Philadelphia to lend her expertise, and that after weeks of painstaking sifting through debris and interviewing witnesses and conducting examinations at ATF's Rockville Labs, the evidence suggested the fire was incendiary and the death, therefore, a homicide. But neither could be proven, and fire modeling could not begin to account for how such a fast-burning fire could have started in a tiny tile bathroom that had nothing in it but a porcelain sink and toilet, a window shade, and a tub enclosed in a plastic curtain. The fire before that, in October, happened in Venice Beach, California, again at night, in an oceanfront house within 10 blocks of the legendary Muscle Beach Gym.
Marlena Farber was a 23-year-old actress whose career consisted mainly of small parts on soap operas and sitcoms, with most of her income generated from television commercials. The details of the fire that burned her Cedar Shake house to the ground were just as sketchy and inexplicable as those of Austin Hart's. When I read that the fire was believed to have started in the master bathroom of her spacious dwelling, adrenaline kicked in. The victim was so badly burned she was reduced to white, calcinated fragments, and a comparison of antemortem and postmortem X-rays of her remains was compared to a routine chest film taken 2 years before. She was identified, basically, by a rib. No accelerants were detected, nor was there any explanation of what in the bathroom could have ignited a blaze that had shot up 8 feet to set fire to the second floor. A toilet, tub, sink, and countertop with cosmetics, of course, were not enough. Nor, according to the National Weather Service satellite, had lightning struck within 100 miles of her address during the past 48 hours. I was mulling over this with a glass of Pinot Noir when Marino called me at almost 1 a.m.
"You awake?" he asked.
"Does it matter?" I had to smile, for he always asked that when he called at impolite hours.
Sparks owned 4 Mac 10s with silencers that he supposedly bought for around $1,600 apiece. He had a Claymore mine he bought for $1,100 and a MP-40 sub. And get this, 90 empty grenades.
"I'm listening," I said.
"Says he was into World War II shit and just collected it as he went along like his kegs of bourbon, which came from a distillery in Kentucky that went kaput 8 years ago. The bourbon he gets nothing more than a slap on the hand because in light of everything else, who gives a shit about that? As for the guns, all are registered and he's paid the taxes, so he's clean on those scores. But this cockeyed investigator in Warrenton has a notion that Spark's secret thing is selling arms to anti-Castro groups in South Florida."
"Based on what?" I wanted to know.
"Shit, you got me, but the investigators in Warrenton are running after it like a dog chasing the postman. The theory is that the girl who burned up knew something, and Sparks had no choice but to get rid of her, even if it meant torching everything he owned, including his horses."
"If he were dealing arms," I impatiently said, "then he would have had a lot more than a couple old submachine guns and a bunch of empty grenades."
"They're going after him, Doc. Because of who he is, it may take a while."
"What about his missing calico?"
"How the hell do you know about that?"
"A calico is unaccounted for, am I correct?"
"That's what he says, but how do you—"
"He came to see me today." There was a long pause.
"What are you talking about?"
he asked, and he was very confused.
"Came to see you where?"
"My house. Uninvited. He had photographs of Claire Rawley." Marino was silent so long this time I wondered if we had been disconnected.
"No offense," he finally said. "You sure you're not getting sucked in because of who—"
"No," I cut him off.
"Well, could you tell me anything from what you looked at?"
He backed down. "Only that his alleged former girlfriend was extraordinarily beautiful. The hair is consistent with the victim's and the height and weight estimates. She wore a watch that sounds similar to the one I found and hasn't been seen by her roommate since the day before the fire. A start, but certainly not enough to go on."
"And the only thing Wilmington PD's been able to get from the university is that there is a Claire Rawley. She's been a student off and on, but not since last fall."
"Which would have been close to the time Sparks broke up with her."
"If what he said was true," Marino pointed out.
"What about her parents?"
"The university's not telling us anything else about her. Typical. We got to get a court order, and you know how that goes. I'm thinking you could try to talk to the dean or someone, soften them up a little. People would rather deal with doctors than cops."
"What about the owner of the Mercedes? I guess he still hasn't turned up?"
"Wilmington PD's got his house under surveillance," Marino answered. "They've looked through windows, sniffed through the mail slot to see if anyone's decomposing in there, but so far nothing. It's like he disappeared in thin air, and we don't have probable cause to bust in his door."
"He's how old?"
42, brown hair and eyes, 5'11" and weighs 160.
"Well, someone must know where he is, or at least when he was seen last. You don't just walk away from a practice and not have anyone notice."
"So far, it's looking like he has. People have been driving up to his house for appointments. They haven't been called or nothing. He's a no-show. Neighbors haven't seen him or his car in at least a week. Nobody noticed him driving off, either with somebody or alone. Now, apparently, some old lady who lives next door spoke to him the morning of June 5th, the Thursday before the fire. They was both picking up their newspapers at the same time and waved and said good morning. According to her, he was in a hurry and not as friendly as usual. At the moment, that's all we got.
I wonder if Claire Rawley might have been his patient.
I just hope he's still alive, Marino said.
Yes, I said with feeling. Me too.
A medical examiner is not an enforcement officer of the law, but an objective presenter of evidence, an intellectual detective whose witnesses are dead. But there were times when I did not care as much about statutes or definitions. Justice was bigger than codes, especially when I believed that no one was listening to the facts. It was little more than intuition when I decided Sunday morning at breakfast to visit Huey Dorr, the farrier who had shooed Sparks' horses 2 days before the fire. The bells of Grace Baptist and First Presbyterian churches tolled as I rinsed my coffee cup in the sink. I dug through my notes for the telephone number one of the ATF fire investigators had given to me. The farrier, which was a modern name for an old-world blacksmith, was not home when I called, but his wife was, and I introduced myself.
"He's in Crozier," she said. "We'll be there all day at Red Feather Point. It's just off Lee Road on the north side of the river. You can't miss it."
I knew I could miss it easily. She was talking about an area of Virginia that was virtually nothing but horse farms, and quite frankly, most of them looked alike to me. I asked her to give me a few landmarks.
"Well, it's right across the river from the state penitentiary, where the inmates work on the dairy farms and all," she added. "So you probably know where that is."
Unfortunately, I did. I had been there in the past when inmates hanged themselves in their cells or killed each other. I got a phone number and called the farm to make certain it was all right for me to come. As was the nature of privileged horse people, they did not seem the least bit interested in my business, but told me I would find the farrier inside the barn, which was green. I went back to my bedroom to put on a tennis shirt, jeans, and lace-up boots, and called Marino.
"You can go with me, or I'm happy to do this on my own," I told him.
A baseball game was playing loudly on his TV, and the phone clunked as he set it down somewhere. I could hear him breathing.
"Crap," he said.
"I know," I agreed. "I'm tired, too.
Give me half an hour."
"I'll pick you up to save you a little time," I offered.
"Yeah, that will work."
He lived south of the James in a neighborhood with wooded lots just off the strip mall-strewn corridor called Midlothian Turnpike, where one could buy handguns or motorcycles or bullet burgers or indulge in a brushless car wash, with or without wax. Marino's small aluminum-sided white house was on Ruthers Road, around the corner from Bonair Cleaners and U-Crops. He had a large American flag in his front yard and a chain-link fence around the back, and a carport for his camper. Sunlight winked off strands of unlit Christmas lights that followed every line and angle of Marino's habitat. The multicolored bulbs were tucked in shrubs and entwined in trees. There were thousands of them.
"I still don't think you should leave those lights up," I said one more time when he opened the door.
"Yo, then you take them down and put them back up again come Thanksgiving," he said what he always did. "You got any idea how long that would take, especially when I keep adding to them every year?"
His obsession had reached the point where he had a separate fuse box for his Christmas decorations, which in full blaze included a Santa pulled by 8 reindeer, and happy snowmen, candy canes, toys, and Elvis in the middle of the yard crooning carols through speakers. Marino's display had become so dazzling that its radiance could be seen for miles, and his residence had made it into Richmond's official tacky tour. It still bewildered me that someone so antisocial didn't mind endless lines of cars and limousines and drunken people making jokes.
"I'm still trying to figure out what's gotten into you," I said as he got into my car. "2 years ago, you would never do something like this.
Then out of the blue you turn your private residence into a carnival. I'm worried. Not to mention the threat of an electrical fire. I know I've given you my opinion before on this, but I feel strongly, and maybe I feel strongly too. He fastened his seatbelt and got out a cigarette. How would you react if I started decorating my house like that and left lights hanging around all year round?
Same way I would if you bought an RV, put in an above-ground pool, and started eating Bojangles biscuits every day. I'd think you lost your friggin' mind.
And you would be right, I said. Look. He played with the unlit cigarette.
Maybe I've reached a point in life where it's do it or lose it, he said. The hell with what people think. I ain't going to live more than once, and shit, who knows how much longer I'm gonna be hanging around anyway.
Marino, you're getting entirely too morbid.
It's called reality.
And the reality is, if you die, you'll come to me and end up on one of my tables. That ought to give you plenty of incentive to hang around for a long time. He got quiet, staring out his window as I followed Route 6 through Goochland County, where woods were thick, and I sometimes did not see another car for miles. The morning was clear, but on its way to being humid and warm, and I passed unassuming homes with tin roofs and gracious porches and bird baths in the yards. Green apples bent gnarled branches to the ground, and sunflowers hung their heavy heads as if praying.
"Truth is, Doc," Marino spoke again, "it's like a premonition or something. I keep seeing my time running short. I think about my life and I've pretty much done it all. If I didn't do nothing else, I still would have done enough, you know? So in my mind, I see this wall ahead and there's nothing behind it for me. My road ends. I'm out of here. It's just a matter of how and when. So I'm sort of doing whatever the hell I want. May as well, right?"
I wasn't sure what to say, and the image of his garish house at Christmas brought tears to my eyes. I was glad I was wearing sunglasses. "Don't make it a self-fulfilled prophecy, Marino," I quietly said. "People think about something too much and get so stressed out they make it happen."
"Like Sparks," he said.
"I really don't see what this has to do with Sparks."
"Maybe he thought about something too much and made it happen. Like you're a black man with a lot of people who hate your guts and you worry so much about the assholes taking what you got you end up burning it down yourself, killing your horses and white girlfriend in the process, ending up with nothing. Hell, insurance money won't replace what he lost. No way. Truth is, Sparks is screwed any way you slice it. Either he's lost everything he loved in life or he's gonna die in prison."
"If we were talking about arson alone, I'd be more inclined to suspect he was the torch," I said. "But we're also talking about a young woman who was murdered, and we're talking about all his horses being killed. That's where the picture gets distorted for me."
"Sounds like O.J. again, you ask me. Rich, powerful black guy, his white former girlfriend gets her throat slashed. Don't the parallels bother you just a little bit? Listen, I gotta smoke. I'll blow it out the window."
If Kenneth Sparks murdered his former girlfriend, then why didn't he do it in some place where nobody might associate it with him? I pointed out. Why destroy everything you own in the process and cause all the signs to point back at you?
"I don't know, Doc. Maybe things got out of control and went to shit. Maybe he never planned to whack her and torch his joint."
"There's nothing about this fire that strikes me as impetuous," I said. "I think someone knew exactly what he was doing."
"Either that or he got lucky."
The narrow road was dappled with sunlight and shade, and birds on telephone lines reminded me of music. When I drew upon the North Pole restaurant with its polar bear sign, I was reminded of lunches after court in Goochland, of detectives and forensic scientists who since had retired. Those old homicide cases were vague, because by now there were so many murders in my mind, and the thought of them and colleagues I missed, for an instant, made me sad. Red Feather Point was at the end of a long gravel road that led to an impressive farm overlooking the James River. Dust bloomed behind my car as I wound through white fences surrounding smooth green pastures, scattered with leftover hay. The three-story white frame house had the imperfect slanted look of a building not of this century, and silos cloaked in creeper vines were also left over from long ago.
Several horses wandered a distant field, and the red dirt riding ring was empty when we parked. Marino and I walked inside a big green barn and followed the noise of steel ringing from the blows of a hammer. Fine horses stretched their splendid necks out of their stalls, and I could not resist stroking the velvet noses of fox hunters, thoroughbreds, and Arabians. I paused to say sweet things to a foal and its mother, as both stared at me with huge brown eyes. Marino kept his distance, waving at flies. "Looking at them is one thing," he commented, "but being bit by one once was enough for me." The tack and feed rooms were quiet, and rakes and coils of hoses hung from wooden walls. Blankets were draped over the backs of doors, and I encountered no one but a woman in riding clothes and helmet who was carrying an English saddle. "Good morning," I said as the distant hammering grew silent. "I'm looking for the farrier. I'm Dr. Scarpetta," I added. "I called earlier." "He's that way," she pointed without slowing down. "And while you're at it, Black Lace doesn't seem to be feeling so hot," she added, and I realized she thought I was a veterinarian. Marino and I turned a corner to find Dor on a stool, with a large white mare's right front hoof clamped firmly between his knees. He was bald, with massive shoulders and arms, and wore a leather farrier's apron that looked like baggy chaps. He was sweating profusely and covered with dirt as he yanked nails out of an aluminum shoe. "Howdy," he said to us as the horse laid her ears back. "Good afternoon, Mr. Dor. I'm Dr. Scarpetta, and this is Captain Pete Marino," I said. "Your wife told me I might find you here." He glanced up at us.
"Folks just call me Huey, 'cause that's my name. You a vet?"
"No, no, I'm a medical examiner. Captain Marino and I are involved with the Warrington case." His eyes darkened as he tossed the old shoe to one side. He snatched a curved knife out of a pocket in his apron and began trimming the frog until marbled white hoof showed underneath. An embedded rock kicked out a spark.
"Whoever did that ought to be shot," he said, grabbing nippers from another pocket and trimming the hoof wall all the way around. "We're doing everything we can to find out what happened," Marino let him know.
"My part in it is to identify the woman who died in the fire," I explained, "and get a better idea of exactly what happened to her."
"For starters," Marino said, "why that lady was in his house."
"I heard about that." "Strange," Dor answered.
Now he was using a rasp as the mare irritably drew her lips back.
"Don't know why anybody should have been in his house," he said. "As I understand it, you had just been on his farm several days earlier," Marino went on, scribbling in a notepad. "The fire was Saturday night," Dor said.
He began cleaning the bottom of the hoof with a wire brush.
"I was there the better part of Thursday. Everything was just business as usual. I shooed 8 of his horses and took care of one that had white line disease, where bacteria gets inside the hoof wall. Painted it with formaldehyde, something I guess you know all about," he said to me.
He lowered the right leg and picked up the left, and the mare jerked a little and swished her tail. Dor tapped her nose.
"That's to give her something to think about," he explained to us. "She's having a bad day. They're nothing more than little children. Will test you any way they can. And you think they love you, and all they want is food."
The mare rolled her eyes and showed her teeth as the farrier yanked out more nails, working with amazing speed that never slowed as he talked. "Were you ever there when Sparks had a young woman visiting?" I asked. "She was tall and very beautiful, with long blonde hair."
"Nope. Usually when I showed up, we spent our time with the horses. He'd help out any way he could. Was absolutely nuts about them."
He picked up the hoof knife again.
"All these stories about how much he ran around," Dor went on. "I never saw it. He's always seemed like a kind of lonely guy, which surprised me at first because of who he is."
"How long have you worked for him?" Marino asked, shifting his position in a way that signaled he was taking charge.
"Going on 6 years," Dor said, grabbing the rasp. "A couple times a month." "When you saw him that Thursday, did he mention anything to you about going out of the country?"
"Oh, sure. That's why I came when I did. He was leaving the next day for London, and since his ranch hand had quit, Sparks had no one else to be there when I came around." It appears that the victim was driving an old blue Mercedes. Did you ever see a car like that on his ranch?
Dora pushed himself back on his low wooden stool, scooting the shoeing box with him. He picked up a hind leg.
I don't remember ever seeing a car like that.
He tossed aside another horseshoe.
But nope. Can't say I remember the one you just described. Now, whoa!
He steadied the horse by placing his hand on her rump.
She's got bad feet, he let us know.
What's her name? I asked.
Molly Brown.
You don't sound as if you're from around here, I said.
Born and raised in South Florida.
So was I. Miami, I said.
Now that's so far south, it's South America.
12. A beagle had trotted in and was snuffling around the hay-strewn floor, going after hoof shavings. Molly Brown daintily perched her other hind leg on the hoof stand, as if about to be treated to a manicure in a salon. Huey, I said, there are circumstances about this fire that raise many, many questions. There's a body, yet no one was supposed to have been inside Spark's house. The woman who died is my responsibility, and I want to do absolutely everything I can to find out why she was there and why she didn't get out when the fire started. You may have been the last person to visit the farm before the fire, and I'm asking you to search your memory and see if there's anything, absolutely anything, that might have struck you as unusual that day.
Right, Marino said. For example, did it appear that Sparks might have been having a private, personal conversation on the phone? You get any idea that he might have been expecting company? You ever heard him mention the name Claire Raleigh?
Dora got up and patted the mare on her rump again, while my instincts kept me far out of the reach of her powerful hind legs. The beagle bayed at me as if suddenly I were a complete stranger. Come here, little fella. I bent down and held out my hand.
Dr. Scarpetta, I can tell you trust Molly Brown and she can tell. As for you, he nodded at Marino. You're scared of them, and they can sense that. Just letting you know.
Dor walked off, and we followed him. Marino clung to the wall as he walked behind a horse that was at least 14 hands high. The farrier went around a corner to where his truck was parked. It was a red pickup, customized with a forge in back that burned propane gas. He turned a knob, and a blue flame popped up.
Since her feet aren't so great, I have to draw clips on shoes to make them fit. Kind of like orthotics for humans, he commented, gripping an aluminum shoe in tongs and holding it in the fire. I give it a count of 50 unless the forge is warmed up, he went on as I smelled heating metal. Otherwise, I go to 30. There's no color change in aluminum, so I just warm it a bit to make it malleable.
He carried the shoe to the anvil and punched holes. He fashioned clips and hammered them flat. To take off sharp edges, he used a grinder, which sounded like a loud striker saw. Dor seemed to be using his trade to stall us, to buy himself time to ponder or perhaps work his way around what we wanted to know. I had no doubt that he was fiercely loyal to Kenneth Sparks. At the very least, I said to him, this lady's family has a right to know. I need to notify them about her death, and I can't do that until I am certain who she is. And they're going to ask me what happened to her. I need to know that. But he had nothing to say, and we followed him back to Molly Brown. She had defecated and stepped in it, and he irritably swept manure away with a worn-out broom while the beagle wandered around.
You know, the horse's biggest defense is flight. Dor finally spoke again as he secured a front leg between his knees. All he wants is to get away, no matter how much you think he loves you.
He drove nails through the shoe, bending points down as they went through the outside wall of the hoof.
People aren't all that different if you corner them, he added.
I hope I'm not making you feel cornered, I said as I kneaded the beagle behind his ears. Dor bent the sharp edges of the nails over with a clincher and rasped them smooth, once again taking his time to answer me.
Whoa, he said to Molly Brown, and the smell of metal and manure was heavy on the air. Point is, he went on as he tapped the rounding hammer, you two walking in here and thinking I'll trust you just like that is no different than your thinking you could shoe this horse.
I don't blame you for feeling like that, I said.
No way I could shoe that horse, Marino said. No way I'd want to, either.
They can pick you up by the teeth and throw you. They paw, cow kick, slap their tail in your eyes. It better be plain as day who's in charge, or you're in for a world of trouble.
Doris straightened up, rubbing his lower back. He returned to his forge to fire another shoe.
Look, Huey, Marino said as we followed. I'm asking you to help because I think you want to. You cared about those horses. You gotta care that someone's dead.
The farrier dug in a compartment on the side of his truck. He pulled out a new shoe and grabbed it with tongs.
All I can do is give you my private theory.
He held the shoe in the forge's flame.
I'm all ears, Marino said. I think it was a professional hit, and that the woman was part of it, but for some reason didn't get out.
So you're saying she was an arsonist?
Maybe one of them, but she got the short end of the stick.
What makes you think that? I asked.
Dor clamped the warm shoe into a foot vise. You know, Mr. Spark's politics piss off a lot of people, especially your Nazi types, he answered. I'm still not clear why you think the woman had anything to do with it, Marino said.
Dor paused to stretch his back. He rotated his head and his neck cracked.
Maybe whoever did it didn't know he was leaving town. They needed a girl to get him to open his door. Maybe even a girl he had a past with.
Marino and I let him talk.
He's not the kind of guy to turn someone he knew away from his door. In fact, in my opinion, he's always been too laid back and nice for his own damn good.
The grinding and hammering punctuated the farrier's anger, and the shoe seemed to hiss a soft warning as Dor dipped it in a bucket of water. He said nothing to us as he returned to Molly Brown, seating himself on the stool again. He began trying on the new shoe, rasping away an edge and pulling out the hammer. The mare was fidgety, but mostly she seemed bored.
I may as well tell you another thing that in my mind fits with my theory, he said as he worked. While I was on his farm that Thursday, this same damn helicopter kept flying overhead. It's not like they do crop dusting around there, so Mr. Sparks and I couldn't figure if it was lost or having a problem and looking for a place to land. It buzzed around for maybe 15 minutes and then took off to the north.
What color was it? I asked, as I recalled the one that had circled the fire scene when I was there.
White. Looked like a little white dragonfly. Like a little piston engine chopper? Marino asked. I don't know much about whirlybirds, but yep, it was small. A 2-seater, my guess is, with no number painted on it. Kind of makes you wonder now, doesn't it? Like maybe somebody doing a little surveillance from the air?
The beagle's eyes were half shut, and his head was on my shoe.
And you've never seen that helicopter around his farm before? Marino asked.
And I could tell he remembered the white helicopter, too, but didn't want to seem especially interested.
No, sir. Warrington's not a fan of helicopters. They spook the horses. There's an air park, flying circus, a bunch of private airstrips in the area, Marino added.
Dor got up again.
I've put 2 and 2 together for you the best I can, he said.
He grabbed a bandana out of a back pocket and mopped his face.
I've told you all I know. Damn, I'm sore all over.
One last thing, Marino said. Sparks is an important, busy man. He must have used helicopters now and then. To get to the airport, for example, since his farm was sort of out in the middle of nowhere.
Sure, they've landed on his farm, Dor said.
He gave Marino a lingering look that was filled with suspicion.
Anything like the white one you saw? Marino then asked. I already told you I've never seen it before.
Dor stared at us while Molly Brown jerked against her halter and bared long, stained teeth.
And I'll tell you another thing, Dor said. If you're out to railroad Mr. Sparks, don't bother poking your nose around me again.
We're not out to railroad anyone, Marino said, and he was getting defiant too. Just looking for the truth. Like they say, it speaks for itself.
That would be nice for a change, Dor said.
I drove home deeply troubled as I tried to sort through what I knew and what had been said. Marino had few comments, and the closer we got to Richmond, the darker his mood.
As we pulled into his driveway, his pager beeped. "The helicopter ain't fitting with nothing," he said as I parked behind his truck. "And maybe it has nothing to do with nothing." There was always that possibility. "Now what the hell is this?" He held up his pager and read the display. "Shit. Looks like something's up. Maybe you better come in." It was not often that I was inside Marino's house, and it seemed that the last time was during the holidays, when I had stopped by with home-baked bread and a container of my special stew. Of course, his outlandish decorations had been up then, and even the inside of his house was strung with lights and crowded with an overburdened tree. I remembered an electric train whirring in circles along its tracks, going around and around a Christmas town dusted with snow. Marino had made eggnog with 100-proof Virginia Lightning moonshine, and, quite frankly, I should not have driven home. Now his home seemed dim and bare, with its shag-carpeted living room centered by his favorite reclining chair. It was true the mantle over his fireplace was lined with various bowling trophies he had won over the years, and yes, the big-screen television was his nicest piece of furniture. I accompanied him to the kitchen and scanned the greasy stovetop and overflowing garbage can and sink. I turned on hot water and ran it through a sponge. Then I began wiping up what I could while he dialed the phone.
"You don't need to do that," he whispered to me.
"Someone has to."
"Yo," he said into the receiver. "Marino here. What's up?"
He listened for a long, tense time, his brow furrowed and his face turning a deeper red. I started on the dishes, and there were plenty of them.
"So how closely do they check?" Marino asked. "No, I mean, do they make sure someone's in their seat?"
"Oh, they do? And we know they did it this time?"
"Yeah, right, no one remembers. The whole friggin' world's full of people who don't remember shit. That and they didn't see a thing, right?"
I carefully rinsed glasses and set them on a towel to drain.
"I agree the luggage thing raises a question," he went on.
I used the last of Marino's dishwashing liquid and had to resort to a dried-out bar of soap I found under the sink.
"While you're at it," he was saying, "how about seeing what you can find out about a white helicopter that was flying around Sparks's farm?"
He paused, then said,
"Maybe before and definitely after, because I saw it with my own two eyes when we were at the scene."
Marino listened some more as I started on the silverware, and to my amazement, he said to me,
"Before I hang up, you want to say hi to your aunt?"
My hands went still as I stared at him.
"Here."
He handed me the phone.
"Aunt Kay?"
Lucy sounded as surprised as I was.
"What are you doing in Marino's house?" she asked.
"Cleaning."
"What?
Is everything all right?" I asked her.
"Marino will fill you in. I'll check out the White Bird. It had to get fuel from somewhere. Maybe filed a flight plan with FSS in Leesburg, but somehow I doubt it. Gotta go."
I hung up and suddenly felt preempted and angry, and I wasn't completely sure why.
"I think Sparks is in a lot of trouble, Doc," Marino said.
"What's happened?" I wanted to know.
"Turns out that the day before the fire, Friday, he showed up at Dulles for a 9:30 p.m. flight. He checked baggage but never picked it up at the other end in London, meaning it's possible he could have checked his bags and given the flight attendant the ticket at the gate, then turned right around and left the airport."
"They do head counts on international flights," I argued. "His absence on the plane would have been noticed."
"Maybe. But he didn't get where he is without being clever.
Marino..."
"Hold on. Let me finish giving you the rundown. What Sparks is saying is that security was waiting for him the minute the plane landed at Heathrow at 9:45 the next morning, on Saturday. And we're talking England time, making it 4:45 a.m. back here. He was told about the fire and turned right around and caught a United flight back to Washington without bothering with his bags."
"I guess if you were upset enough, you might do that," I said.
Marino paused, looking hard at me as I set the soap on top of the sink and dried my hands. "Doc, you gotta quit sticking up for him," he said.
"I'm not. I'm just trying to be more objective than I think some people are being. And certainly security at Heathrow should remember notifying him when he got off that plane."
"Not so far.
and we can't quite figure out how security knew about the fire anyway. Of course, Sparks has got an explanation for everything. Says security always makes special provisions when he travels and meets him at the gate. Apparently the fire had already hit the early morning news in London, and the businessman that Sparks was supposed to meet with called British Air to alert them to give Sparks the news the second he was on the ground.
And someone's talked to this businessman?
Not yet. Remember, this is Sparks' story. And I hate to tell you this, Doc, but don't think people wouldn't lie for him either. If he's behind all this, I can guarantee that he planned it right down to the fine print. And let me also add that by the time he'd arrived at Dulles to catch the flight to London, the fire was already going and the woman was dead. Who's to say he didn't kill her and then use some kind of timer to get the fire going after he'd left the farm?
There's nothing to say it, I agreed. There's also nothing to prove it. And there doesn't seem to be much chance of our knowing such a thing unless some material turns up in forensic exams that might point to some sort of explosive device used remotely as an igniter.
These days, half the stuff in your house can be used as a timer. Alarm clocks, VCRs, computers, digital watches.
That's true. But something has to initiate low explosives, like blasting caps, sparks, a fuse, fire, I said. Unless you have any other cleaning to do, I added dryly, I'll be heading out.
Don't be pissed at me, Marino said. You know, it's not like this whole damn thing is my fault.
I stopped at his front door and looked at him. Thin gray wisps of hair clung to his sweating pate. He probably had dirty clothes flung all around his bedroom, and no one could clean and tidy up enough for him, not in a million years. I remembered Doris, his wife, and could imagine her docile servitude until the day she suddenly left and fell in love with another man. It was as if Marino had been transfused with the wrong blood type. No matter how well his meaning or brilliant his work, he was in terrible conflict with his environment, and slowly it was killing him. "Just do me one favor," I said with my hand on the door. He wiped his face on his shirt sleeve and got out his cigarettes. "Don't encourage Lucy to jump to conclusions," I said. "You know as well as I do that the problem is local law enforcement, local politics. Marino, I don't believe we've even come close to what this is all about, so let's not crucify anyone just yet."
"I'm amazed," he said. "After all that son of a bitch did to run you out of office, and now suddenly he's this saint?"
"I didn't say he was a saint. Frankly, I don't know any saints."
"Sparks, the ladies' man," Marino went on. "If I didn't know better, I'd wonder if you were getting sweet on him."
I won't dignify that with a response. I walked out onto the porch, halfway tempted to slam the door in his face.
"Yeah, same thing everyone says when they're guilty."
He stepped out after me.
"Don't think I don't know it when you and Wesley aren't getting along."
I turned to face him and pointed my finger like a gun. "Not one more word," I warned him.
"You stay out of my business, and don't you dare question my professionalism, Marino. You know better than that, goddammit."
I went down the front steps and got inside my car. I backed out slowly and with deliberate skill. I did not look at him as I drove off. 13. Monday morning was carried in on a storm that thrashed the city with violent winds and pelting rains. I drove to work with windshield wipers going fast and air conditioning on to defog the glass. When I opened my window to toss a token into the toll bin, my suit sleeve got drenched. And then of all days for this to happen, two funeral homes had parked inside the bay, and I had to leave my car outside. The 15 seconds it took me to dash through the parking lot and unlock the back door of my building concluded my punishment. I was soaked. Water dripped from my hair and my shoes squished as I walked through the bay. I checked the log in the morning office to see what had come in during the night. An infant had died in his parents' bed. An elderly woman appeared to be a suicidal overdose. And, of course, there was a drug-related shooting from one of the housing projects on the fringes of what had become a more civilized and healthy downtown. In the last several years, the city had been ranked as one of the most violent in the United States, with as many as 160 homicides in 1 year for a population of less than 250,000 people. Police were blamed.
Even I was, if the statistics compiled by my office didn't suit the politicians, or if convictions were slow to come in court. The irrationality of it all never ceased to appall me, for it did not seem to occur to those in power that there is such a thing as preventive medicine, and it is, after all, the only way to halt a lethal disease. It truly is better to vaccinate against polio, for example, than to deal with it after the fact. I closed the log and walked out of the office, my shoes carrying me wetly along the empty corridor. I turned into the locker room because I was already getting chilled. I hurried out of my sticky suit and blouse and struggled into scrubs, which were always more unwilling the more I rushed. I put on my lab coat and dried my hair with a towel, running my fingers through it to push it out of my way. The face staring back at me in the mirror looked anxious and tired. I had been neither eating nor sleeping well, and was less disciplined with coffee and alcohol. All of it showed around my eyes. A good deal of it was due to my underlying helpless anger and fear brought about by Carrie. We had no idea where she was, but in my mind she was everywhere. I went into the break room where Fielding, who avoided caffeine, was making herb tea. His healthy obsessions did not make me feel any better. I had not exercised in over a week.
"Good morning, Dr. Scarpetta," he cheerfully said.
"Let's hope so," I replied, reaching for the coffee pot. "Looks like our caseload is fairly light so far. I'm leaving it up to you, and you can run staff conference. I've got a lot to do." Fielding was crisp and fresh in a yellow shirt with French cuffs and vivid tie and creased black slacks. He was cleanly shaven and smelled good. Even his shoes were shined, because unlike me, he never let life's circumstances interfere with how he took care of himself.
"I don't see how you do it," I said, looking him up and down. "Jack, don't you ever suffer from normal things like depression, stress, cravings for chocolate, cigarettes, scotch?"
"I tend to overcondition when I get whacked out," he said, sipping his tea and eyeing me through steam. "That's when I get injured." He thought for a moment. "I guess the worst thing I do, now that you have me thinking about it, is I shut out my wife and kids, find excuses not to be home. I'm an insensitive bastard, and they hate me for a while. So, yes, I'm self-destructive, too. But I promise," he said to me, "if you would just find time to fast walk, ride a bike, do a few push-ups, maybe crunches, I swear you'd be amazed." He walked off, adding, "The body's natural morphines, right?"
"Thanks," I called after him. "Sorry, I asked."
I had barely settled behind my desk when Rose appeared, her hair pinned up and fit for a CEO in her smart navy blue suit. "I didn't know you were here," she said, setting dictated protocols on top of a stack. "ATF just called. McGovern."
"Yes?"
I asked with interest. "Do you know about what?" "She said she was in D.C. over the weekend and needs to see you."
"When and about what?"
I began signing letters.
"She should be here soon," Rose said.
I glanced up in surprise.
"She called from her car and told me to let you know that she was almost to King's Dominion and should be here in 20 or 30 minutes," Rose went on.
"Then it must be important," I muttered, opening a cardboard file of slides. I swung around and removed the plastic cover from my microscope and turned on the illuminator.
"Don't feel you have to drop everything," said the ever-protective Rose. "It's not as if she made an appointment, or even asked if you could fit her in."
I set a slide on the stage and peered through the eyepiece lens at a tissue section of pancreas, at pink and shrunken cells that looked hyalinized or scarred. "His tox came back as zip," I said to Rose, as I put another slide on the stage. "Except for acetone," I added. "The byproduct of inadequate metabolism of glucose. And kidneys show hyperosmolar vacuolization of the proximal convoluted tubular lining cells, meaning instead of cuboidal and pink, they're clear and enlarged."
"Sonny Quinn again," Rose said dismally.
"Plus we've got a clinical history of fruity-smelling breath, weight loss, thirst, frequent urination. Nothing that insulin wouldn't have cured. Not that I don't believe in prayer, contrary to what the family has told reporters." Sonny Quinn was the 11-year-old son of Christian Science parents. He had died 8 weeks ago, and although there had never been any question as to his cause of death, at least not in my mind, I had finalized nothing until further studies and tests had been completed. In short, the boy had died because he had not received proper medical treatment. His parents had violently protested the autopsy. They had gone on television and accused me of religious persecution and of mutilating their child's body. Rose had endured my feelings about this many times by now, and she asked, "Do you want to call them?" "Want has nothing to do with it." "So yes." She shuffled through Sonny Quinn's thick case file and jotted down a phone number for me. "Good luck," she said, as she passed through the adjoining doorway. I dialed with dread in my heart. "Mrs. Quinn," I said when a woman answered. "Yes? This is Dr. Kay Scarpetta."
This book is continued on Disc 7.